I'm Robert Sickles, and I'm here with Kim DeKeefel and our long-lost co-podcaster, Matt Reynolds. Yay. Welcome back, Matt.
Thank you.
And this is the cold open number 46. The way, way too long movie edition, part one, Babylon, which will be what we focus on here. So let's get right to it. Matt, as a welcome back.
Thank
give
you.
Give us your reaction to this very, very, very long movie.
Yeah.
So excited to hear this.
I think I have a lot to say about Babylon, given some of my research interests in the past. But I also still don't really know what to think about Babylon.
Yes.
Although I will say, when I walked out of the theater with Lisa and our 16-year-old daughter, Mika, side note, don't take your 16-year-old daughter to go see Babylon.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to sit very far away from her.
Yes.
My first reaction was I hated that. And I still think that's largely my reaction, but I also am genuinely interested to talk about it with the two of you, because I wouldn't, even though I hated it, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's a bad movie. I think it's kind of well made,
right,
in a messy, sprawly, almost like a 70s excessive kind of way. You know, I mean, the film touches on different eras of Hollywood cinema. And it felt like one of those, like a, almost like a Heaven's Gate or something, you know, like they,
yes,
like they, like they just didn't know when to say no to Damien Chazelle. And he just continued to do whatever it was that he wanted to do. But that's, I think that doesn't give it enough credit, because I think it's actually kind of like tight and focus in its own weird way. So I'm kind of interested to hear what the two of you have to say about it.
Thank you, Matt. I agree. I've been grappling with this since we watched it, and I've been thinking of it as an eighth grade love letter to cinema, as in it's full of all the feelings. There's some funny stuff in there. There's some great rhythms. There's also no subtext, and it's completely uninterested in historical accuracy or even characters. But I feel like that's why it's a little eighth grade. It's like well-meaning, it's smart for in certain ways. There's some moves there, but it's inarticulate, I guess, or like kind of fulminating at the at the source of Chazelle in this well-meaning sort of mess.
Yeah.
A little bit, right? So so eighth grade love letter. How about you, Robert? What do you think?
I think it's objectively bad.
Okay.
Like I think it's a
thank
bad,
God, because I thought I was gonna be such a bitch.
I think it's a bad movie.
Okay.
That said, I think it's a really noble failure. Like, how can you not like someone who takes a big swing? And
yeah.
I certainly don't regret having seen it on the big screen. There's no, I would have turned it off had I been watching this at home.
Sure.
I was really, really bored for most of the movie. For a movie that is trying so hard to be so flashily entertaining and showing you everything at Mach 10, I found that kind of surprising. I got really bored during like the very, very long opening orgy scene. I'm like, please stop. Like, what is the purpose of this? So, and to your point, Matt, it's expertly made. Like, the craftsmanship, it's beautifully made, and there's something in this era of superheroes and fish people, like this idea that it's mostly practical effects. Like, it's old school style movie making.
Shaw's celluloid.
Yeah, that's about old school style movie making. So it's just kind of neat to see some of the stuff. So like, I'm glad he made it. I'm dumbfounded that it got made for the budget that it got made for, and that they allowed it to be. I mean, this was a 184 page script initially. It's not like
it's 4 hours, right?
It's not like it didn't turn out like it was supposed to turn out. It's not like they told him make it a 90 minute movie, but why anybody would have ever invested in this is beyond me. And it's kind of funny that you mentioned Heaven's Gate, because that made sense. That was, even though it was like a massive failure, maybe killed a studio, et cetera, it was like an era in which studios didn't know what they were doing, as we were getting conglomerates taking over the studios and they were trying to find marketable things. They were willing to take big swings. And we just aren't. That is the antithesis of the era that we're in now. So I'm just kind of fascinated by it. But again, I don't regret having seen it. I think it's a noble failure, and I don't ever see myself seeing it again.
Yes.
I think I agree with what you're saying. The like 40 minutes into it, when the opening credit comes.
Yes.
The opening title card is like, oh no.
That was the cold open.
I think it's, you know, I appreciate that it's reflective. And it's, I think what's unique about it is that it is reflective in its own excess, in a way that other excessive bloated bombs in the past are just not, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I just was like pulling my hair out in that the montage at the end, which is like shows all the, that was really bad. That was really, really bad.
It was sloppy. Like,
yeah, very sloppy. And so like, so stupid. So, yes. Fan, that you get the title card, the fan title card, which precedes then all of the computer graphics. So like the first shot after the fan du cinema, the end is a scene from Tron. And it's like, that's way too simplistic for a movie that's trying to say, you know, that the golden era of Hollywood, the silent era, was not as golden as we think it was. And the beautiful sound era, you know, that's like kind of, and yeah, what's going on with the scene in the rain sequence too, which I like, that went on and on and on. And I appreciated that it was trying to revive some of that nostalgia about Singing in the Rain, but then it only ultimately reinforces it. With him, you know, crying because he lived through that transition to sound and he saw how it ruined people's lives. And then ultimately he loves Singing in the Rain, right, too, because how could you not love Singing in the Rain? And so he's laughing and he's applauding and stuff like that. So,
that constant reference to Singing in the Rain for me weakened the movie. Singing in the Rain's great.
Yeah.
Like, it's so much better at doing what in a lot of ways Babylon seems to be trying to do, that it was just, oh, I don't know that you want to keep drawing the parallels to this particular movie.
Drawing them out, like that was really, really a long sequence.
Well, there's so many references to so many different movies. I was particularly struck by the reference of Margot Robbie watching herself on the big screen. She had to tell the people that she was in the movie and they let her in. It's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
It's Sharon Tate. Like, it's the exact same kind of scene done over, but there were like moments and moments and moments of that. And I don't know whether it's homage or just maybe, who knows, it randomly happened. But so here's a big question I have for y'all, because it's what I was thinking of. There's a lot of understanding of film history in this room, right? And I'm assuming that though we probably missed large parts of it, we still caught a lot of stuff that a lot of people are not likely to see or get the parallels or whatever. So who is this for? Like, who was this movie for? What do you think?
Exactly. I don't know. This, I was asking my husband Jeremy this, where it was like, who is the audience for this show, and what are they meant to take to, right? Like, Matt, do you have a theory on who this is for?
It's a good question. I don't know. I do think it's for cinephiles, yes. But like, what, that's a very increasingly niche market. And I don't know. Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah.
So
who do you think it's for?
Well, I don't know. I kind of think it's for cinephiles, but let me rephrase the question. Can you like it if you don't have any interest in cinema history? Is there anything that would appeal to you about this movie?
I don't think so. I'm struggling with that, quite honestly, because of the lack of interest in developing a potentially interesting set of sort of analog characters representative of certain archetypes throughout the star system. But I don't feel like any of it like finishes its sentence, or the narrative is, again, messy, sloppy, and sort of frustrating, as in also what I was continually annoyed with is there were so many opportunities for us to understand connections beyond the melodrama of like the moon-eyed Manny being in love with Nelly. Like, there were so many points to me that were opportunities for where we could have seen these people actually having each other's backs, or being an ensemble of some sort, or being the underrepresented people of some sort. Even in that fancy party scene, right, when Margot Robbie is, decided in the My Fair Lady of it all, she's deciding to thwart being fancy and shoves that food in her face and then pukes on the rug, which I did enjoy a little bit. But what I thought should have happened is we should have seen those characters react to each other, as in like Sydney should have been like, me too, or somebody should have been connected to somebody else in some way beyond being like bafflingly in love with the other. Do you understand? Do you know what I mean? Where there was the opportunities for narrative and fabric that were like continually missed, and that pissed me off. I don't care. You know.
I really liked Margot Robbie's performance in the sense that she gave it her all, but it was a completely underwritten cipher of a character that and in fact I actively disliked her, which is not disqualifying for liking a film. There's plenty of movies where I don't like the character, but I like the film. And in fact, some of them you like because you don't like the character.
Exactly,
right?
Yes.
Like Tar, if any of you have seen that, it's just really fun to watch that. But she was screeching and hysterical and untamable in a way that I just found kind of sad and pathetic, not like interesting or like a free spirit kind of person. And it's interesting that you named Sydney. When I was watching the movie, both the Sydney Palmer character and the Lady Faye, those were by far the two most interesting characters for me. And I would have loved to have seen an alternate version of this that wasn't about Manny and Jack and Nelly, but was instead about Sydney and Lady Faye. And I'm not saying that like for woke purposes or anything like that, but they were more interesting. I was more interested. That's a story I haven't heard.
Yes.
How did this person navigate that system?
I loved those characters.
Yes.
And oddly, for what I feel like Chazelle was stabbing at and grabbing at as far as what he was trying to do, those characters, they get so much less screen time and so much less story, which I feel like he undoes himself over and over in that sense, where it was like, I don't think you're doing what you think you're doing. You know what I mean? Like, and those characters are the example of that, where it's like, why didn't we flesh that out? Why do we have to follow Jack Conrad through all 11 marriages, but we don't get like, we get one slip of Sydney's like fancy new house and that's it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it was frustrating.
So were there things about this that y'all like liked? When you watched this, what gave you pleasure? What did you like? Were there moments?
Well, so just to kind of answer that and follow up on the last point that you were making about character development and who the audience is, I think this was a kind of revisionist historical take on Hollywood, in the sense that the woman director at the beginning during the silent era is prominent during that whole sequence, and also another underdeveloped character. And Robert, sorry if I'm stepping on your toes here, but I did see in your notes that a reference to Kenneth Anger's Hollywood Babylon books.
For sure.
And I think that that is a really huge, important point that needs to be brought up in relation to the film, in the sense that Anger's Hollywood Babylon books are a kind of queer reimagining of that era of Hollywood. And so I think Chazelle in some ways is trying to recapture a little bit of that. He's trying to remind us though that Hollywood was a very different, less corporate, less more diverse industry in those early years. And it reminded me of like another movie that I thought just handled this so much better. And that's the documentary about Alice Guy Blaché, that goes through her career, placing her alongside all of the great, directors of at the birth of cinema, and then tells this story about the ways in which women were, women directors in particular, and producers, but on all aspects of production, were systematically excluded. Going so far as to say, like Wall Street and the corporations that own the Hollywood studios were explicit about this, saying like, yeah, we'll give you more money, but the women have to go. And so I felt like Chazelle was trying to kind of squeeze some of that story into this. And I was interested in that. But again, there's another movie out there that tells that story in a much better way. And I was thinking about that other movie the whole time I was in that, watching Babylon.
It's an excess of ambition, right? You can't tell all of these stories. I'd love to see a movie, maybe there is one, but about Anna May Wong. Right?
Like yeah.
That would be a really intriguing movie, but it's just, you can't tell all these stories. And in addition to the Anger book, there is Kevin Brownlow's The Parade's Gone By, which is a huge kind of informing thing of this too. And the really kind of interesting part of that is Anger's is mostly fictional and Brownlow's is
or
mostly
imagined.
Not.
Yeah. Anger's is the Hollywood that as a young gay man he wants to he's reading in between all of this stuff and all of the publicity and like imagining these relationships, but Brownlow's is capturing the
and I don't know if it's historical either, but or true, it's definitely historical, but it's first person interview, it's basically an oral history in there.
Well, you speak to my favorite character, which is played by Olivia Hamilton, who is the partner of Damien Chazelle, which is interesting to learn later. The female director, her parts of the movie to me are the strongest because there's rhythm to it. I spoke to rhythm earlier, but those repetitive sort of almost musical pieces of her having her open the door, come through the door, the take seven, take eight. But before that opening sort of epic scene where we see Margot Robbie get her first chance with Dancing on the Bar, right? I absolutely loved those pieces of the movie were, to me, the strongest in that they were the most articulate, clear love, but they were fun and they had momentum, whereas that was lacking elsewhere. I loved the rhythm of certain pieces. The opening number oddly did not have the rhythm it should have. And I actually feel that way about another Chazelle flick, which is La La Land. That should have been the coolest opening number. I'm sorry, you gotta have a good opener, right? And that was not the best song by far in La La Land, that first number. I think you and I talked about this a little bit, Robert, but I feel like that opening strong, that's that he wants to so badly. And he tried so hard with that orgy, but how can an orgy be boring? I don't know, but he managed that. And I also feel like it was these sort of lesser versions of other maybe homage parts. I couldn't help but think of Boogie Nights and that continuous shot that is so strong and so good in that opening number, that opener to that movie. But I did love the moments of rhythm and the moments of sort of what I felt like clarity. And Olivia Hamilton, oddly, was the centerpiece in my mind of both of them, which was this excellent female director who got to be a piece of it. So I appreciate you saying that too, Matt, where it's like, do you think he was trying to get at something, and that revisionist piece is interesting, but I feel like it fell short a few times, but that felt like it came through.
Yeah.
There's like a satiricon element to opening scene as well.
Yes.
Clearly
yes.
Sees like there's a little homage to that. So here's the weird part about this movie. There were three different scenes in this movie that were as good as any I've ever seen in a movie. And that's why maybe I'm so frustrated with the movie as a whole. The scene where Manning was trying to get a camera to literally, like, where they were the racing against the dying of the light, and we were seeing Jack get increasingly drunk, and we were seeing Nellie show that she can cry one tear or two, supposedly Clarabelle could do. But, like, that sequence was thrilling, but it had, kind of speaking to your concerns, Kenneth, it had structure.
Yes.
Like, you're racing the sun. Yeah. Like, it was this really kind of beautiful thing, and the way it ended with a drunken Jack Conrad being able to hit his mark, say his line,
right.
You take the girl with
yes.
the light in the background. Yeah. Like, that was magical. The scene where they did 8 takes of the scene with Nelly that they were trying to get. I don't know if y'all have ever seen the Tom DeCillo film Living in Oblivion, but it kind of starts like that, where they do a take over and over and over again. But I thought that was magical. Like, that was so cool to see that, and the increasing tension. It was like the guy dies in the final take. I just really liked that. And I adored the scene where Eleanor St. John, the Jean Smart character, told Jack Conrad, like, how he'll be remembered.
That was
like,
beautiful.
That he would never, that was my, and I was like, oh, that's what this movie's about.
Yeah.
For me, that was, it was really, like, Jean Smart, please put her in more things more often. For
she's a genius. She's a genius. It was so beautiful. That piece was clarity to 100 more of you and 100 more of me.
And those three really stood out. I kind of liked it when she fought the snake. Like, it was funny, but it was just kind of ridiculous.
Oh, my
goodness. The flip side of this, man, I hated that scene with Tobey Maguire where they went into the asshole of Los Angeles.
Terrible.
Like, what was the point of that?
It rang so false as far as what the future of entertainment. I was like, it was so inarticulate. Although Tobey Maguire was enjoying himself so much being whatever that character was, that it was at first enjoyable, and then it was endless.
So maybe that's the anger element, right? Because there's no reference to anything like that actually having been around during that time.
I feel like I'm fairly knowledgeable about the history of Los Angeles and film history, but I don't know of anything like that. Although that does allude to all of the noir, you know, like the Black Dahlia and the James Ellroy stuff, you know, and the classic noir of the 40s and 50s. But so those scenes of excess, the throw up scene, the shit scene, which opens the movie, the elephant shitting on the guy, both of the guys, like, over and over and over again. Like, it just goes on and on and on. And then that scene, too. Again, like, why didn't somebody tell him no, you know? But I think that he had an idea in his head about the purpose of those excessive scenes.
Yes.
And what they meant. But I still can't quite... I don't think I can figure it out.
But there's not a good movie in here, I guess, is what I would argue. I don't see, based on what we saw, who knows what they filmed that we didn't see, I don't know what you can cut out of it to get to that tight narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it can be a David Lynch film. It doesn't have to have a narrative progression.
Yeah.
But at least a more intriguing narrative. I don't know what you cut to get. There's not like a brilliant 90-minute film.
Right.
In here, I think it was fatally doomed from the start.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, I agree. So can I change the subject just slightly? And so Lisa, my partner, pointed out that there is an idea floating around, or a rumor floating around, that this will be the second of a trilogy of films about L.A.
Oh,
so beginning with La La Land, this film, and then another film. I can say I'm not really looking forward to the third installment of this trilogy at this point, but I did think that there might be some truth to that with the music, which was very strange, I thought, in the movie. Like, so the jazz score that echoes the, like, some of the, you know, the motifs from La La Land. Every time I heard that, like, little bit of La La Land musical, it pulled me right out of this movie, you know?
Yep.
And so, but again, it was a moment where I thought, well, maybe there's something larger going on. I can't imagine that the powers that be will greenlight a third movie after this, but I don't know. Chazelle is, maybe they just gave him the keys to the car and said, go ahead and do it, and we'll work it out later. I don't know.
Apparently, he's going to make a movie about the big band, like the swing revival in Los Angeles in the 2000s, early 2000s, late
1990s. Oh, okay.
See, now that I feel like...
Okay, total bullshit.
Oh, come on.
Because
I wanted to see if he would go for it.
He's going
to
be a swingers.
Yeah. I believed you.
So,
swingers, exactly.
I'm on that out because I love the music. And that was the one thing, if you're going to say what is Chazelle's signature, it was like, oh, this is completely, like, in line with him. And the music was my favorite part of the movie. Like, I just really liked the movie, even if maybe it was incongruent to what we were watching. Although it wasn't, when there's a lot of it that's meant to be ambient, right? The band is actually playing in the scenes. I really liked the music quite a bit.
Oh, I didn't dislike the music. I the score for La La Land is a... It feels more contemporary, even though it references classical jazz, it's a contemporary score.
Right.
And whenever I heard those motifs repeated in this movie, again, it was like one of the historical inaccuracies or anachronisms that just pulled me out of the narrative. So,
right, because was it like confidently anachronistic that it was like basically a honky-tonk, like the piano that was repeating the through line melody, especially when we see Nelly and Manny's talk. It's like this honky tonk, like 1906 style. It's either way in the future or way in the past.
Right.
But I did think the Sidney Palmer big band pieces were electric. I don't argue with that at all. Like that was beautiful, exciting work. But it is, now I'm thinking what this third movie is going to be, though. I'm just like, I would kind of love a 70s, 80s like LA. If I don't know if Chazelle's the one, but I would love to see that. I think Ty West is the one with Maxine, but that's just me.
So to get back to Matt's idea about this, or Chazelle's idea, maybe being the second of a trilogy, I think we need to just think about what this movie means industrially. It was rumored to have cost somewhere around $80 million. That's what they're saying. It was originally supposed to be made for Lionsgate, but Paramount ended up kind of buying the idea and funding it. And it's been guessed that after like marketing, et cetera, somewhere around $150 million to make this film, and that it would need to make $250 to start turning a profit. It was tracked to make in between 12 and 15 million on its opening weekend, and it made three.
Ooh.
As of yet, it still hasn't even made 14 million. It hasn't been released internationally yet, but it's a bomb. This is not going to make money abroad either. It's not enough to even make back its production budget. So we're at this moment where carte blanche deals with directors is over, and where we've really seen this that has kind of driven this market is streaming, where Netflix will give a gajillion dollars to Scorsese to make a movie for Netflix, The Irishman, or where Netflix gives a bunch of money to make Roma. So these streaming companies wanted to be in business with the name, and they were willing to just give buckets of money to have the cultural cachet of having these films on their services. And maybe to some extent, Paramount wanted to be in the Damien Chazelle business, but where the stock market has turned on streaming companies and movie companies, and they don't want the promise of future growth via subscriber numbers, but actually like profits. I think we can say that the era of these companies giving these carte blanche deals for directors to make their personal visions, I think it's done. I think it's over. I think it's going to be very hard to make non-IP movies at this kind of price level. The movie looked great.
It did.
Like, yeah. There was no question, where did the $80 million go? I never thought,
It looked expensive.
It looked amazing. So where are we industrially? Like, is this a death knell?
I another good question, Robert. I think that and I was reminded of another huge bomb with Margot Robbie recently, Amsterdam, which was also a prestige project for David O. Russell, and that's that also was not a good movie. That was really, really way too long. Also very boring, very excessive, and. So, you know, if those are the two case studies, then if this era is over, then maybe it's not such a bad thing. Although I'm a little, where does that leave us then? Does that leave us with just more superhero movies, just more mid-tier horror movies like Megan? That are automatically guaranteed to find an audience, but really aren't doing a whole lot more than just trying to make their money back.
So that classic, like, mid-budget adult-oriented film, which is, you know, $20 to $50 million historically, the idea was that maybe that couldn't be made theatrically anymore, but that they would find a place in the streaming world. And maybe now that the streamers are just cutting back so crazily, these investments in the hope of attracting subscribers with these prestige projects, I think they're going to go away. I'm really concerned about the future of not art films per se, but films with like artistic intention. And you know, maybe Babylon, like I said, is not a good example, because I think whoever funded this thing, they were just, I don't know how they weren't wrong from the start. I don't know how they weren't told, hey, maybe this isn't the one where you want to invest this kind of dollar, even with the star power that it had. So I really am kind of concerned. And you know, I'm sure you've read like The Fabelmans, Tar, whatever. These movies are not doing well. Like, adult oriented dramas are not doing well. Maybe that'll change after the Oscar nominations come out.
It's almost like the pandemic, like I don't know if they cut all the marketing departments, but it's almost like people forgot how to market a movie. And because I would go see those movies here in Walla Walla, but Avatar is playing in three theaters, Megan is playing in three theaters, you know, like that, like that. And so we get Avatar, Megan, whatever big animated movie is out at the
Black Panther's still here,
Black Panther. And the fucking Jesus movie, you know, like whatever religious movies.
Welcome to the West. I have to say that Puss in Boots was infinitely better than Babylon.
It was excellent.
Infinitely better.
It was so good. The writing was solid. Yes.
It was really an accomplishment.
It was.
It was like it's a reboot of a franchise based on a subsidiary character from the sequel of the original movie of that franchise.
Yes.
That does not seem like a recipe for success.
No, whose trait is cute eyes.
Right.
It's
yeah.
very deep for that.
Small miracle. Pretty. Small miracle.
I found it interesting just to sort of connect to that marketing piece. That sort of thank you ahead of time, the little intro by Margot Robbie and Papa was so, I was hoping for a win, because I was like, oh, they're trying so hard to save cinema. It was just such an interesting, weird little piece. And I feel like there's been a couple movies where, the actors sort of thank you for coming to the big theater, and it made it sadder that it wasn't a good movie.
I would argue that Margot Robbie is kind of a consummate actor and can do anything. And yes. She seemed really sincere that, but Diego Calva acted like he was at gunpoint.
Yes, he like did.
The introduction.
Yes. Yeah, someone was threatening him off screen.
So the flip side of that.
You're right.
Tom Cruise made me want to run through a wall to watch Maverick. His introduction beforehand, I was like, this is amazing. He was so into it. It was so exciting. And he just like... That man sold that movie. Like, nobody's business.
Oh my gosh, totally. Yes, there's a better version of that. That's beautiful. You're right. Calva was not, like, totally, his eyes were, he was a little switchy for that intro.
Well, do you have any other things about Babylon?
I have no more Babylon things.
I just want to say there one thing I read about it was interesting in that it said that I think it was the New York Times review is saying that because of the lack of development, it made the tragedy melodramatic and the comedy decorative. And I thought that was so beautifully put. What's too bad is that there were those moments of clarity and genuine comedy. And then it kind of just got in its own way, but I appreciate the big swing too. I like how what did you call it? A successful failure? Noble failure. Thank you. So I do appreciate it too. I'm so glad to see it on the big screen, but yeah, I'm not gonna see it again.
Well, so to bring it full circle back to Matt's referencing the 70s and 70s filmmakers and Heaven's Gate in particular. So Heaven's Gate is kind of one of those movies that if you have even the slightest familiarity with movie history, like, you know, you can reference even if you haven't seen it, right? The Heaven's Gate means something. It's not just a California cult, where they all killed each other. But it is it means a moment in time in history. And I wonder if Babylon in time will become shorthand. If you say, Babylon, you're referring to this moment, this fleeting last gasp at big budget, artistic-minded filmmaking.
Yeah.
Well, and since we're on the topic of flops, and maybe I won't say any more after this, but it can't help but recall, too, Griffith's Intolerance, which I think was also a massive flop, huge flop. It was his apology for Birth of a Nation, and it had these like four different segments, and it was a spectacular production, of which the elephants of Babylon were situated at the corner of, like, the remnants of the set was still visible on the corner of Sunset and on Sunset Boulevard, and then finally cleared away. And then when they rebuilt the Hollywood and Highland Mall, the elephants were used as a motif in that. So the Babylonian elements, the elephants, now I just read that they're taking those elephants down. That too was a kind of interesting thinking about, like, kind of the urban history of Hollywood specifically. It's making me kind of a little bit want to go back and watch Intolerance, but I don't think I'm actually going to do that. But there may be more there to that connection than I'm remembering.
So it's funny you should say that, though, because Hollywood has been dying and rebirthing itself forever.
Yeah.
It's hard when you reference Intolerance, I immediately thought of Greed, which is, of course, referenced in the film.
Yeah.
Right? You have Spike Jonze playing like an Eric Von Stroheim.
Yes.
Kind of an uncredited Spike Jonze. Yeah.
Playing, he was great in that.
He was fantastic. I loved him. Yeah.
But, the flops are as much a part of Hollywood lore as like the legendary successes.
Yeah.
And maybe that it may well find a place. I have a hard time believing it's going to find a second life via streaming just because it's so long. I think this would be really hard to watch it at home.
I think so.
We'll call it a day. So for Kendi Kiefel and Matt Reynolds, I'm Robert Sickles, and this has been The Cold Open number 46.